cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
The less your business spends, the more margin you keep. But today, everything costs more. So smart businesses are graduating to NetSuite by Oracle. NetSuite is the number one cloud financial system, bringing accounting, financial management, inventory, and HR into one proven platform, helping you reduce IT costs, maintenance costs, and manual errors. Over 37,000 companies have already made the move to NetSuite. Backed by popular demand, NetSuite has extended its one-of-a-kind flexible financing program for a few more weeks. Head to netsuite.com/earnings. netsuite.com/earnings.
Bloomberg Audio Studios.
Podcasts, radio, news.
This is Bloomberg Business Week. Insight from the reporters and editors who bring you America's most trusted business magazine.
Plus global business, finance, and tech news.
The Bloomberg Business Week podcast with Carol Messer and Tim Stenebeck from Bloomberg Radio.
We've been bouncing around a lot today. The rally in stocks definitely taking a breather today, Tim. Market, though, I think still heading toward its best week in 2024. A lot of it has to do with speculation that the Fed ultimately could be moving to cut rates as early as June. So that's giving certainly a lift to the trade.
Well, Ryan Dietrich expected the U.S. economy to avoid a recession last year. He also bet that inflation would cool sooner than the market was expecting. He added exposure to stocks during the banking turmoil last March and as the S&P 500 sank in October. In hindsight, pretty good calls, and it's why Bloomberg included Ryan in a story about the stock optimists who nailed 2023, and that was back in December.
You get to wear that mantle for a little while longer, Ryan. Let's get to the interview. With us is Ryan Dietrich. He's chief market strategist at the Carson Group. He's back with us from Cincinnati. Good to have you back with us. We have had quite a run. This could be the best week that we've seen all year. Does it feel like technically or even fundamentally in your view that we're getting a little frothy, that there's time that we need a little bit of a maybe correction or at least a little bit of a pullback?
Yeah, Carol, Tim, thanks for having me back. And as someone whose mom passed away last year due to cancer, obviously thinking about Princess Kate and the whole royal family and all of our friends over in England and London there with the UK, I guess, with everything that just came out in the last hour
Thank
or so.
Thank you for that.
But getting to the question there, no easy way to transform from what we just talked about, but let's just do it. Listen, yes, we are looking at maybe a 27% rally in 21 weeks since that late October low. That's one of the greatest 21-week rallies ever. Today could be, fingers crossed, the 21st all-time high already this year for the S&P 500. If you extrapolate that out, guys, that's like over 90. What does that mean? The previous record was 77 all-time highs in 95, meaning this could be one of the, in theory, one of the best years we've ever seen. Yes, we think maybe we're due for a little pause. We've been overweight equities. I've come on with you for a while saying we're still bullish. We don't see a recession. We just have to be, be aware that what happened yesterday, 118 stocks in the S&P 500 made a 52-week high, the highest number we've seen in 3 years, okay? That can be sometimes a near-term kind of, I don't say blow off top's the right word, but at least need for consolidation. But rarely with that many stocks making a 52-week high, does that mean the ultimate peak? This happened, like March and April of 21. Remember what happened the rest of 21? Pretty good year last I checked. So we're still bullish, but hey, maybe we're due for a little break.
When you say a little break, a little bit of a pullback that we're due for, what are you talking about, Ryan? What would be within your model?
Yeah, I mean, between 5 to 7% will be perfectly, perfectly normal. Nothing abnormal. I mean, for the S&Ps, like we talked about, up 10% for the year, up, 27% the last 21 weeks. And again, what's been happening, what's so impressive, and you guys have talked a lot about this. If you told me Apple will be doing what it's been doing, Tesla's doing what it's doing, and we kick back the idea of when the rate cuts will be and how many there will be, Biden said, oh, you know what? Market might be in a little trouble. That's not what's happened, right? What have we seen? Rotation, rotation, rotation. You've got small caps and mid caps doing really well this week after the Fed, but I'm more impressed, or we're more impressed, with the industrial leadership, the cyclical leadership, your financials, your materials. The fact that those groups are doing well, to us, message of the market, cyclical leadership says, hey, this is strong, and maybe we can just kind of have the baton passed around, and we're still, those are the groups we've liked, and we still like them.
Interesting. So, because I was just looking at some of the notes when we wrote the story, Bloomberg News put the story out back in December. You said small caps, mid caps, and financials. Those are three of your favorites. They continue to be three of your favorites. Recession, that's not even in your playbook at all for 2024?
Well, it's not. It actually wasn't in our playbook last year. That wasn't very popular when we said that last year. But no, still, we still don't see a recession. I mean, earnings this year expected to be up 10, 11%. And I know those are estimates that can potentially change. But the bottom line, the consumer is still strong. Look at those initial claims, still around 200,000. We know the big layoffs some of the big tech companies have had, but we're just not seeing that go into the consumer. I mean, consumer is still strong, still healthy. And final comment, you know, wages are like 4 to 5% this year. Inflation's around 3.5%. I mean, wages are still growing faster than inflation. That's normally a positive sign, and we still think the consumer is going to lead this economy the rest of this year, maybe even further.
Hey, Ryan, we spoke to somebody yesterday who's not necessarily on the same page, and look, this is what makes a market, but curious what you'd, what you'd say to her. Cheryl Smith over at Trillium Asset Management. She's an economist. She's a portfolio manager there. She thinks we're 4 to 6 months away from a recession. She's starting to see cracks or softness, she said, in many of the state unemployment figures. She's seeing credit card delinquencies going up. What say you of that data?
Yeah, we are starting to see some of that, those delinquencies. I can't disagree. I mean, it is what it is. But again, when you look at those, is it more normalizing? We had historically low delinquencies this time 2 years ago, right, with all the government giving people money and different things. Now we think it's more normalizing right now. And the other side to that, I mean, listen, interest rates are higher. There's a lot of debt out there. People are paying a lot more interest on the debt that they have. People seem to forget, though, the other side of that, I mean, $6 trillion in money markets, I'm not so sure that's just going to lead money markets go to stocks. I'll be very clear. But people are comfortable getting their 4 to 5%. If you look what's happened the last 3 years, the money people are paying on interest for debt over here is actually offset by what they're getting on interest in their money markets. People don't always talk about that. And again, I know a lot of people are struggling, but just the truth, net wealth's at all-time high. Net wealth's actually growing faster. You know, assets are growing faster than liabilities. If you look at the data from the Fed. So it's not perfect. But again, I don't see a recession in 6 months, put it that way.
Hey, Ryan, what's stronger, the technical story for stocks to continue to move higher or the fundamental story for stocks to head higher?
Yeah, I think the technical, I mean, great question. I mean, we've got a little bit of both, but I think it is a technical. I just talked about all those new highs that we just saw. You know, we had the 50th trading day of the year last week. We were up more than 5% as of the 50th trading day, Carol. I took a look. What happens? It's a good start to a year. Let's be clear. 25 times we at the 50th day were up at least 5%. The rest of the year was higher. Are you ready for this? 24 out of 25 times. I've come on with you guys a lot using stats like that, and I know they're just one stat. Don't invest blindly in anything, no one stat. But we've seen a lot of those, factoring in the fact that what the Fed has said, there's probably three cuts coming. The Fed just upgraded their view on GDP. I mean, I hate to say it's like this, you know, perfect nirvana that we're living in right now, but it really is. Things are a lot better. And maybe what worries me, though, guys, I know it's a logical question. What worries me the most, I'm looking around, and a lot of people that were bearish last year are now bullish.
Well,
a lot
of people are optimistic right now.
That kind of worries me a little bit, right? Mm-hmm. What Patton say, if everybody's thinking alike, somebody isn't thinking. I mean, maybe that's where that little well-deserved break could be needed, because there's a lot of Johnny-come-lately bulls that they were yelling at me a year ago.
Ryan, election year, that's one thing.
Yeah.
And then, okay, so now you said, too, that we're kind of expecting the Fed to make three rate cuts. If they don't do that, and then let's throw on the election year on top of it, those are two big things. Does that in any way kind of change or could change your outlook, your optimistic outlook here?
I mean, it could change it a little bit, but I mean, honestly, you know, what were we looking for? 5 or 6 cuts this time 2 months ago, and now we're looking at 3 cuts probably. Why? Because the economy's been stronger. In 2022, the Fed was more hawkish, if you will, because of inflation. Now they're a little bit more hawkish than where they were 2 months ago because the economy's strong. So we like that. Real quickly on the election, a lot of people have talked about this, but in an election year, when you have a president up for re-election, like we do, the last 10 times, going back to the 50s with Eisenhower, the S&P 500 was higher every every single time, 10 out of 10, up 12% on average. It's almost where we are now. But just because it's an election year, don't get overly concerned or worried. History says election years do just fine, especially with an economy strong like this one.
Hey, Ryan, what changes your mind? What turns you bearish? What data would you need to see over the next few months in order to change your view?
Yeah, great question there. So as someone who looks at the market from a technical point of view, if we started to see leadership from areas like utilities, like staples, a real estate, that would worry me. That if people forget this. In late 2021, it was a great bull market. Where was the leadership in the fourth quarter? Those more defensive areas. And we all know what happened, obviously, in 2022. Mm-hmm. But fast forward to right now, we're seeing relative strength lows in utilities and staples. So I'm not seeing that yet. So that's the first kind of crack to me if the defensive things start to lead. We're not seeing it. We're seeing cyclicals lead. So that's still a reason to be bullish.
Any new names for the upside or downside that have popped up on your radar? Just got about 45 seconds left.
Well, no individual names, but we like mid-caps a lot. I mean, mid-caps are that area. Mm-hmm. Everyone talks about small caps, large caps. I mean, mid-caps are up about 8-9% for the year. Nobody's talking about it, right? I mean, I think that's an area that quietly could do very, very well this year as everyone argues about, you know, the Red Sox or the Yankees or small caps or large caps. We like mid-caps a lot, Carol.
All right, going to leave it on that note. I'm looking at the S&P 500 Mid-Cap 400 Index. It's up about 7.6% so far here in 2024. Hey, Ryan, thank you so much. Really appreciate it. Ryan Dietrich joining us, Chief Market Strategist at the Carson Group, joining us once again from Cincinnati.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
It's hard to believe it's been a little more than a year since a key lender in the world of technology and startups came undone, collapsing and requiring the U.S. federal government to step in. That failure, the second largest in U.S. history and the largest since the financial crisis of 2008, it wasn't alone in terms of troubles in the regional banking sector. Signature Bank, First Republic, and the group continues to be on everyone's radar.
It does indeed. And with one perspective, and why we have heard a lot of senior execs in the banking sector talk about the value of being boring, that is, including our next guest. With us now is none other than the chairman and CEO of PNC Financial Services, home to PNC Bank, Bill Demchak. He's joining us now from Pittsburgh. Bill, great to have you here with us. And I got to ask, is that a Bloomberg behind you?
Of course it's a Bloomberg.
All right.
So nobody send Bill and I B right now. He's on TV.
I am probably one of your earliest Bloomberg clients.
Interesting.
Way back to the early 90s on the trading floor.
All right. There are some stories there, not only about that, but also about what you have seen. Well, let's start there. I mean, I really appreciate someone who has been within the financial industry and then the banking industry for a while. You've seen a fair amount of cycles. You've seen crises. What's the best word to describe today's banking environment and kind of business and economic environment? And they don't have to be the same word.
Yeah. Look, I think banking is a little bit unique at the moment because we're in this uncertain period, as a function of pending regulation, the impact of interest rates and when the Fed's going to ease or not ease. So it's a little bit different. I think the economy is kind of what you read about. It feels pretty healthy. It's slowing at the margin from a rapid pace. Labor's good. At least inside of PNC, we're largely on the same page with Chair Powell on his recent comments.
What can you tell us about your customers right now? And I ask because we had a really interesting conversation with the president and CEO of Citizens Bank of Edmond. I mean, this is a tiny bank in Oklahoma, one physical branch, and they have an online business with 1,000 customers. So, I mean, we're talking tiny. But Jill Castillo told us yesterday that she's never seen a better environment for her customers. Things are really, really good right now.
It's Jill's actually a good friend. She's not wrong. On the corporate side, there's areas of weakness, but there's a lot of areas of strength, particularly as we kind of lean into manufacturing and onshoring again. The consumer, yeah, it varies by income level. We've obviously seen basic wages increase a lot, particularly at the lower level. But at the same time, we've seen the prices of their staple goods increase more compounded through time than their wages have, even though in many instances wages have doubled. So, you know, it varies.
Well, and, you know, we kicked off here, you know, Bill, getting into you that 1 year, essentially, a little bit more than 1 year since Silicon Valley Bank and the collapse of it. Do you feel like we're out of that environment? And I think one thing we have learned is, right, that not every bank, not every regional is the same and in terms of their exposure. But we're still kind of a little concerned about commercial real estate, not sure that we've gotten through that. So when it comes to concerns within some of the banking sector, do you think that we could see more trouble still, depending on their exposures?
At the margin, probably in smaller banks, most of which you will never have heard of. I think, first of all, as you know, I don't particularly like the term regional. It's not very descriptive of anything anymore, particularly in a digital age.
So I'm not going to call you a super regional, which people call you sometimes.
No, I don't know what to, we're a national bank.
I know you are.
That campaign in a second, but you know, practically, and you see the same numbers I do, is banks get smaller, they tend to have a higher concentration of real estate. Their concentration of real estate tends to be more fixed rate, medium term in length, and B and C properties, you know, so permanent financing on older B and C properties, which is kind of the area that's going to get hit the most, and a higher rate environment with, you know, increased office vacancies. But it's not a systemic issue, certainly for the banking industry, not for any of the names you will otherwise know. And we'll make our way through it.
Well, let's talk more broadly just about real estate, and talk to us a little bit about your own exposure to real estate and commercial real estate. How can you characterize that for us?
Look, it's a small percentage of our total loans, not a big percentage of our capital. We have plus or minus $8.5 billion, I guess, in total, what you would define as office. And that is where all the spotlight is, starting to shine on multifamily, but we're not seeing stress in multifamily at the moment, notwithstanding, you know, news that you might see out of New York and affordable and other places. Generic multifamily is doing just fine. But inside of office, you know, say we have that $8.5 billion, there's about $4.5 billion to $5 billion that is multi-tenant. And that's where the problem is. And we expect problems there, and we're reserved to quite a high level against it. And thus far, as we've cycled through, you know, these projects that go non-performing, we've actually been conservative in what we've been reserving. So we feel okay about it. We're heavily reserved today. It's gonna, you know, most of our stuff comes due over the next year. So, you know, it's kind of project based. They come online. So we're gonna know the answer to this pretty quickly, I suspect.
Ah, interesting. Hey, listen, we also said that boring is something that you guys are tapping into. We've got a great chart that we can share with those who are watching right now that our producer, Elizabeth, is going to share out with everybody. But it talks about bank management, not just your own, but others using boring on calls this year, quarterly update calls and earnings calls. It is up a lot. Boring, not a bad thing. And you guys have an advertising campaign that you are stressing that.
No, we do. I mean, I'll make a couple of points. I think if you look back in history, I've talked about our bank and banking in general as kind of 3 yards in a cloud of dust. And you grow, you know, with GDP. And if you're good at it, you can outpace that. But we are, by our very nature as an industry, when you see outliers to that, there tends to be something going on underneath that. And when we think about, you know, we use the word boring. I don't necessarily like to think of myself as a boring person,
but I didn't mean
banking
that.
Ought to be. No, I get it. But boring, you know, banking shouldn't be drama for our clients. Mm-hmm. It ought to be predictable, consistent. Stuff works. They know their money's safe. They don't have to read about us in the headlines.
Right.
And that's who we are. That's how we define ourselves. You know, we right. to the core of this company, to the very best of our ability, we try to do right by all of our constituents every day. And when we screw it up, we fix it.
Bill, we're going to leave it on that note, but hope we can get you back here real soon. Bill Demchak, he's CEO at PNC Bank, joining us from Pittsburgh. You are listening and watching Bloomberg Business Week.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Success is more than the final destination. It's a path you take one step at a time. It's discipline. It's teamwork. And it's the drive and passion inside of us that comes before all recognition. It's what Stifel's been doing for over 130 years. Quietly, yet strategically, Stifel's become one of the fastest growing wealth management and investment banking firms in the country. Our financial advisors go beyond traditional wealth management to provide clients with direct access to one of the industry's largest equity research franchises and a leading middle market investment bank. Because success is the drive it takes to keep climbing, the passion to keep investing, the best of each of us made better by the best in all of us. And that is where success meets success. Start your journey at Stifel.com. That's Stifel.com.
Stifel Nicolaus and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Listen live each weekday starting at 2 p.m. Eastern on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. You can also listen live on Amazon Alexa from our flagship New York station. Just say, Alexa, play Bloomberg 1130.
It was a big week for IPOs. Reddit raised nearly $750 million, pricing shares at the top end of the range. Shares surged in their debut, closing higher by more than 48% yesterday. The other big tech IPO of the week is the semiconductor-based connectivity company, Astera Labs, surging 72% in its debut and continuing to climb higher in subsequent days. Carol, in fact, about $9.1 billion has been raised this year via IPOs on U.S. exchanges. That's according to data compiled by Bloomberg. It's an increase of around 160% compared to this point last year. So does that mean we're seeing a thaw?
It's a good question, right?
In the IPO market?
I don't know.
Okay, Kelly Rodriguez has his finger on the pulse of what's going on with pre-IPO companies. He's the CEO of Forge Global. It's a company that gives investors access to shares of privately held companies and gives employees of those companies the opportunity to sell those shares. So if you want to buy shares of OpenAI or Anduril, for example, accredited investors can do just that on Forge. Kelly, good to have you on the program. You've got a great view into the IPO market. Are we all good now? Is the thaw happening?
Yeah, it's happening. It's a question of how quickly is it happening. As we're seeing IPOs start to gain traction, buyers are coming back to the private market, which is a good indication.
So how different is it than last year, for example, at this time? Like, give us some numbers about who's coming back and how much they're coming back.
Well, first, let me just remind everybody, you know, we run the leading private securities marketplace, and we track a lot of data. And so we just put out our private market update. And here's what we're seeing a shift for sure. Buy interest has exceeded sell interest for the first time in over 2 years. The bid ask spread in the private sector has reduced to 10.8. percent, and we're seeing year to date, March is hinting at a potential recovery on the horizon. But we saw this begin really at the beginning of last year. But we're pretty optimistic about what we're seeing. I think people are going to watch these IPOs and see how they fare. There are a lot of companies that still want to get out, and they're watching what happens with Reddit. And Astera.
And is that why you think it's happening? I mean, you say buy interest exceeding sell interest. Why do you think it's happening? Is it, you know, expectations of a lower rate environment and an easier environment for either new issues, if you will, or just kind of the equity universe overall? Like, why is it?
Well, I think what we saw, and this is where it needs to be understood, we call this period in the private market the Great Reset. after the 2021 exuberance, bear in mind the private markets lag the public markets considerably. Mm-hmm. And so there's been disrupted fundraising dynamics in play, questions about have we hit the bottom and whether or not the IPO window is closed. A lot of that sentiment has caused the private markets to freeze. And so the thawing really started later than what you saw in the public markets. And what we look for is a sustained amount of data that tells us that it's coming back. And so what we're seeing now is a convergence of some of that data. Example being the 75 most liquid names are in the Forge Private Market Index. That declined last year 20% while the S&P was up over 20%. But now, given where we sit this year, year to date, we're seeing the first increases in the index in the private market. That's an indication that people are getting more active, coming in, and they're watching the IPO window. So think of it as the IPO window opens, and that's an indication that private market investing will start again, and companies that were going to go public back in 21 and didn't and couldn't go out in 22 or 23 are lining up to watch and see what happens here with Reddit and Astera.
Hey, Kelly, how is this playing out on the marketplace right now? In that, are you seeing a lot of employees who have equity tied up in these privately held companies? Are you seeing a willingness on their part to part with that equity? And what's the price, like in general, what's the premium that you're seeing there?
Okay, so we have seen 2 years of unprecedented sell side pressure. Holders of these securities, not just employees, but investors that came in early, have been trying to sell or looking to sell for 2 years. That's why when we track the bid-ask spread for the last couple of years, it's been in the mid-20s to low 30s. The fact that it's come down means people are now able to start selling. But bear in mind, just a little bit of valuation metrics that are going on. If you look at the market today, 75% of the fundraising or transactions that are happening at or below the last fundraising levels.
Yeah, the so-called down rounds.
Yes, I mean, 75% of the market is trading below. The 25 that's trading above, you've got a pretty steep premium actually at the top 10% of the market. So that top 10% of the market's being driven a lot by the AI craze. And the AI craze has brought, you know, some energy back into the market. There's buy side interest across the entire spectrum of AI players, Scale AI, Figure AI, Perplexity, Grok. So there is some activity happening there. And yes, there's a lot of sellers that are now finding buyers for their shares and are willing to sell at whatever the discount that's required to get that liquidity. It is improving though.
That's what I was going to ask you though. How much is it AI companies, AI related? I'm also curious about where crypto kind of falls into this interest, or has that really, you know, we saw Bitcoin certainly and a lot of other cryptocurrencies on a run. We've seen a little bit of a pullback, but I'm just curious the types of companies that you're seeing where there's interest.
So, you know, we trade at any given time in about 200 active names. Mm-hmm. AI is at the top of the list. Obviously, crypto is one of these cyclical sectors that when it's hot, people want to buy it and it sort of tracks accordingly. I'd say overall, if a company is performing well, if there's growth and they're putting up numbers that are essentially turning the market towards more reasonable valuations, they're still going to see premiums in the share price that they're getting. I mean, yesterday we announced, for example, the launch of Forge Pro. This is really geared towards the institutional investors that are now coming back into the space and are looking for a combination of a trade settlement system with all of the data and pricing information that would inform their re-entry back in the market. The market is still pretty discounted. I'd say there are very good deals that are trading now that are at 50% of their last round valuations. But at the top of the market, you're definitely seeing valuations go back up and players enter the market and watching the IPO space. And if this continues, I think we'll see more IPOs in 2024 and even bigger volumes coming.
Hey, Kelly, I do want to just talk briefly. We only have about a minute left, but year-to-date, Forge Global down over 30%, close to 34%, down more than 90% from all-time highs back in 2022. What's, in your opinion, is the market missing about the valuation of your own company that is publicly traded?
I think, you know, you can never predict the sentiments of public investors fully. But we left 2021 with spectacular numbers, and the market's been recovering, and our revenue has been down on low volumes for 2 years. I think, like everything else, our last couple of quarters have demonstrated steady improvement. We've got our earnings call on Tuesday, and we think the markets, particularly the institutional investors that have looked at Forge, love the story of what we're doing. They're waiting for the performance of the market to come back. And we're working diligently on building technology that will enable the market at scale. And I think the combination of that investment and the performance that we see going forward will put us in a position to be judged by the market accordingly in 2024. So we remain optimistic.
Kelly, appreciate you taking the time and joining us. That's Kelly Rodriguez, CEO of Forge Global, joining us from California. Thanks so much, Kelly. Really appreciate it.
When cyber criminals strike, the difference between a catastrophic event and resilience is preparedness. Finance leaders who plan ahead can thwart the damage posed by ransomware. Yet in a recent EY poll, only 23% of directors expressed confidence in their organization's ability to respond to a ransomware attack. Cyber preparedness is just one facet of the complex risk landscape finance leaders face every day. Now more than ever, it's vital to keep ahead of developments. Cybercrime, macroeconomic conditions, ESG reporting. You can't predict the future, but you can prepare for it. By understanding your risk, you can make your business resilient to challenges on the road ahead. What's more, you can turn those risks into opportunities. EY helps CFOs, boards, and audit committees see beyond the numbers to uncover the critical insights that make their organizations resilient, even in an ever-shifting landscape. For more insights that matter, visit ey.com/beyondthenumbers.
Hi, I'm Ron Kruszewski, Chairman and CEO of Stifel. Financial advisors, if you're not growing your practice, you're losing market share. Stifel is a growing, entrepreneurial, advisor-centric firm built for successful advisors like you. Imagine having the resources of the largest wirehouses and the support of the boutique shops, but none of the bureaucracy to get in the way of you serving your clients. At Stifel, it's your business, your book, your clients. I always tell the advisors we're recruiting, I want you to come to Stifel and double or triple your business. Most of them laugh and shake their heads, but I'm serious. Don't take it from me. Take it from Stifel's number one finish in J.D. Power's 2023 U.S. Financial Advisor Satisfaction Study. So, there's a reason why 148 financial advisors joined Stifel last year. Come join us and find out why Stifel is the firm where success meets success. Visit www.choosestifel.com.
Stifel Nicholas and Company Incorporated, member SIPC and NYSE.
You're listening to the Bloomberg Business Week podcast. Catch us live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern. Listen on Apple CarPlay and Android Auto with the Bloomberg Business app. Or watch us live on YouTube.
All right, let's get to it. As stocks are headed for the best week of the year, time for a drive to the close guest. Data Diori is back with us, co-chief investment officer over at InvestNest. They are a tech company, provides a software platform for the wealth management industry. They've got about 108,000 advisors on their platform with a total. Those advisors have a total of about $5.8 trillion in assets. So a nice little vantage point that she certainly has, Tim.
Dana, how are you? Good to have you with us this afternoon.
Be here. Thanks for having me.
Yeah. Okay. So I want to talk a little bit about what you're seeing on the platform right now. You're in a unique position of having an overview from so many different of so many different financial advisors around the country who work with so many different people. Carol mentioned some of the stats there. 108,000 advisors. Give us an idea about what you're seeing on the platform right now.
Sure. Well, we look at flows, obviously, and you know which asset classes are gaining the interest. I think not surprisingly, we've seen a lot of interest in short-term fixed income in the last year, and even recently. You've seen obviously money market assets ballooning. And, you know, the platform's kind of seeing the same thing. U.S. equities as well have been an area of, you know, just in terms of the overall allocation, if you take the average allocation across the different programs, U.S. equity, short-term fixed income, those are areas that have been gainers.
Okay, so how is that different than where we were, let's say, a year ago? I mean, Carol and I have talked about this quite a bit. We're up close to 30% right now in the S&P 500. Not quite there since those October lows of just a few months ago. How is the activity different than what you saw a year ago when there was so much concern out there that the U.S. would be in a recession imminently?
Yeah, I think there was definitely a lot of, you know, there was a lot of talk around, hey, we need to shore up fixed income positions and make sure we're rebalanced properly into fixed income. And that I would say is probably the big difference. I mean, of course, you know, to be clear, right, we're a platform with advisory assets that are across asset allocated models.
Right.
So these are incremental changes that we're going to see, right? Most people are, you know, fully allocated, but those are the big ones I'd say are the differences between what we saw a year ago and where there was maybe more interest in some of the different fixed income than there is.
Any sentiment out there? Like we were talking earlier, Dana, that all of a sudden it seems like the pessimists are all of a sudden now turning optimists and people are kicking up their targets for the S&P 500. When everybody gets optimistic, I'm like, it doesn't make me feel good. But tell me what you're seeing in terms of sentiment indicators and maybe what it tells you about the outlook here.
Yeah, certainly we sit at the junction of a lot of different research, and you're absolutely right. You know, it's hard to be a bear in this market, but we're about 2 years after the start of the tightening cycle. And ironically, you know, now is when you might want to be shoring things up traditionally for the expectation of potentially not getting that soft landing. So I would say that there's not a lot of bears. You know, and there is, you know, obviously discussion around this bull market versus other bull markets, small caps versus large. But I do think, you know, at the end of the day, there are plenty of people who recognize that, yes, I should still have ballast in the portfolio, right? And nobody's kind of moving away from that. And yes, you know, we're not going to get probably as many interest rate decreases, all else equal, what we know today, that as maybe we thought we would. And we're not necessarily completely out of the woods. So, you know, hard to be moving out of markets, and certainly we're not recommending that people do.
Right.
But at the same time, keeping that 40 in your 60-40 is still important.
Hey, Dana, without opening up kind of the safe on the amount of information that you can see from all of those investment advisors.
You can open up the safe. Not going to argue with
That are on your platform. But you do, one of the reasons we like, and I've said this before, and I know, Tim, we both feel this way, that, you know, one of the reasons we like talking to you is because you do have so many advisors on the platform and there's a lot of information and data flow. And I do, you know, I'm hearing what you're saying in terms of the broad macro thing, but I mean, are there any interesting new trends in terms of what investors are doing? Is it moving money more into equity? Is it moving market and, you know, money into alternative out? Like, what is it that you're seeing in particular? And also like with the treasury trade and what it tells you about kind of expectations from the Fed longer term.
Yeah, it's not at the aggregate level. It's not a ton of tactical. I will tell you, interestingly, we're monitoring Bitcoin and the new spot ETFs there pretty closely. We have, you know, obviously Grayscale on the platform. And is there going to be, you know, movement from Grayscale into some of the Bitcoin ETFs? You've seen the spot Bitcoin ETFs kind of just explode within literally a month, you know, at an industry level. And so that's kind of something we're watching, and we're seeing assets starting to flow that way as we would expect. I think it's an interesting place if you're, you know, a financial advisor. Perhaps your clients were doing their crypto trades outside of what you oversaw. Now you've got vehicles where you, as the advisor, if the client wants to do it, it's a speculative trade, no question about it. But if your client is doing, you know, Bitcoin, would you like that to be something that you at least oversee, that you can at least offset from a tax perspective, or, you know, kind of monitor and keep discipline around the size of the position? So I think that's one, you know, in terms of just kind of popping things, that's one area that I would point to.
How would you characterize the interest overall on the platform in it as an asset that people actually want in their portfolios?
You know, I will say to you that the managers are kind of, they're stepping carefully on this. What's interesting about it, I think, is that certainly you've seen the big asset managers come out with these funds. But I would say that to a certain extent, that sort of de-risks maybe what people were already doing. If I wanted access to spot Bitcoin, I can get it now in a vehicle that's backed by these very large asset managers. And so to a certain extent, that might de-risk if I was already going to be in it. I think what's interesting to watch with the asset managers is, you know, when do some big asset managers start putting this into if they start putting it into big asset allocation models, because that now brings in clients who would not on their own otherwise have gone, you know, and it kind of legitimizes it in a very different sense. And so in a sense brings the risk into the model, you know, depending on what you think, you know, is a reasonable risk. There is research out there that, you know, the upside potential is so high and people like that lotto payoff, that small allocations, 1 to 3%, aren't an outrageous idea. But at the end of the day, does that belong in, you know, a fully asset allocated model that's there for the client's retirement? So I think that's going to be the interesting thing to watch. We haven't seen any big model management doing that yet.
Hey, what, Dana, is a smart conversation around small caps versus large caps versus maybe mid caps? We talked with Ryan Dietrich earlier, and he's got some interest in the mid cap space. He was smart on calls last year, but I'm just curious, when you start to break down the market among the different market cap sizes, what's the smart conversations that you are hearing from some of your investment advisors?
Yeah, the thing about that is that it's really hard to get away from large cap. You know, whether you're passively managed, you're in an index solution, or even if you're actively managed, it's very hard for active managers on the platform and anywhere, right, to be taking massive tracking error risk to this market and missing out on, you know, the drivers of return, which have been those, as you know, ultra large growth stocks. So, you know, any amount of tilting towards small cap, I think, helps alleviate some of that concentration risk. Obviously, we've been talking about Apple and you know, making no statement one way or the other on it, but just kind of does highlight the fact that, you know, the concentrated market does bring with it a certain amount of risk that we've ignored, you know, and it's become, you know, mega cap has become quality, synonymous with quality, but it is a concentration risk. And so I think there is an effort and an interest in, you know, where the breadth in the market and having, you know, an allocation that includes these non-mega caps. You know, on a personal note, small value has outperformed over time. So I think, yeah, you know, to the extent you could take a little tracking error going there is not a bad idea.
All right, we got to run. Hey, listen, Dana, have a great weekend. Dana DiOria, she's co-chief investment officer at Envestnet.
This is the Bloomberg Business Week podcast, available on Apple, Spotify, and anywhere else you get your podcasts. Listen live weekday afternoons from 2 to 5 p.m. Eastern on Bloomberg.com, the iHeartRadio app, TuneIn, and the Bloomberg Business app. You can also watch us live every weekday on YouTube and always on the Bloomberg Terminal.
Join us in Chicago or virtually on May 2nd for Bloomberg's Business Value of AI event and networking reception. This event will gather business and technology executives to share their experiences and provide insights into their strategies for deploying AI that achieves a desirable ROI. You'll also learn how companies have successfully implemented AI solutions that have improved productivity and profitability. This program is proudly sponsored by IBM. Register at BloombergLive.com/AI/radio.